Radio Times. With President Obama's win this month, it looks like the Affordable Care Act is here to stay. The deadline for states to decide on whether to establish a health care exchange and partner with the federal government or let the government run the exchange has been moved to December 14th. States are also deciding about how to fund the expansion of Medicaid. Key provisions have been instituted since the health care law was passed, with many more to be rolled out over the next few years. In this hour of Radio Times, we get an update on the Affordable Care Act, what it means for consumers, for health care professionals, hospitals, estates, and the federal government. And we have two guests who have joined us. Noam Levy is a national health care reporter for the Los Angeles Times Tribune at their Washington Bureau. And Noam Levy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
Also with us is Julie Rovner, health care policy correspondent for NPR, joins us from NPR. And Julie Rovner, nice to have you with us as well.
My pleasure.
Julie, let me begin with you. Barring some unforeseen circumstance, when will the Affordable Care Act be fully in place?
Well, the main parts that most people have been waiting for will be in place on January 1st, 2014. So that's just a little over 11 months from now.
And Noah, what's the thinking behind the piecemeal implementation of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, there were a number of considerations. Probably chief among them, cost. You know, the coverage expansion that's projected to go in place in 2014 and cover ultimately close to 30 million new people is a costly enterprise. I mean, the cost of expanding Medicaid for low income people, the cost of providing subsidies for middle and low income people is well over $1 trillion over a 10-year period. So by pushing it off, they were able to phase in some of the costs, as well as give states and the federal government time to put in place something that's quite complicated.
Which is what they are doing. Now, Julie, even going back to what has been implemented over the last couple of years, and it's not always clear that the people know what kind of health care coverage they have, can you list what's in place today?
That's right. There are a number of things that are already in place that people are seeing. One of the biggest ones that I think people are taking advantage of is this ability for young adults to stay on their parents' health plans until they're age 26. Often what happens is kids graduate from college, they get jobs that don't offer health insurance, and they have no way of getting health insurance. Now those kids can stay on their parents' plans so they can go travel the world, or they can take an internship that perhaps doesn't offer health insurance. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 million young people have been able to maintain their health insurance because of that. There have been a lot of changes to health insurance plans, no more annual and lifetime limits on health insurance. There are now these new requirements for health insurers to spend most of their money on actually providing medical care rather than on administrative or overhead costs or profit. And this year, before the election, many people got refunds from their insurance companies. Those were all things that were due to the new health law. There are also high-risk pools for people who haven't been able to get health insurance. There have been bans on pre-existing conditions for children. There are new tax credits for small businesses, for very small businesses. So there are a lot of things that have affected particular pieces of the health industry, but the really big parts, the no pre-existing conditions for adults, this expansion of Medicaid, these new health exchanges where people will be able to go to buy health insurance, those are the things that take effect in 2014.
And Noam, looking at what has been implemented, is it too soon to know whether that has reduced costs and even improved care for those getting health care in this country?
It probably is. The costs have continued to rise in healthcare, as have premiums. There's some evidence that there's been slowing some places, but I think the promise that the president made in pushing the law that it would reduce costs in the system and for consumers has yet to be realized, and frankly, I think is going to be a challenge even going forward. As to some of the other impacts of the law, I think there has been some evidence that they're beginning to have effect, most notably in a way that perhaps many consumers may not feel quite yet. But there's been a fairly dramatic reshuffling and reorganization going on in the healthcare sector, in which hospitals and doctors and other providers are working together or joining together to coordinate care for patients. That was a goal of the Affordable Care Act. It was one that many people doubted would have much of an effect. It's sort of designed to provide medical care more rationally to patients. That's happening quite rapidly around the country. There's some question about what the ultimate impact of that will be. There's some concerns about costs and so forth. But I think on balance, people who look for a more rational way for health care to be delivered in this country are encouraged by what they're seeing.
And what's the main driver for the rising costs?
Well, I mean, there are many different things driving up the cost of care. I mean, primarily prices. The price for everything from a lab test to a CT scan to a transplant in this country is just much higher than it is anywhere, most other places in the industrialized world. And tackling that problem is a major challenge.
Well, and I wonder, Julie, looking at the number of baby boomers starting to retire and will be retiring over the next 20 years, how much is that a cost driver?
It is going to be. You know, we've been extremely lucky these last couple of years. The recession did one thing. It hugely dampened the demand for medical care. And we saw that. We've seen it in past recessions. We saw it really in a dramatic way in this recession, that there was just a dramatic drop in utilization. And that happened to coincide just with the beginning of the baby boom starting to qualify for Medicare. So I don't think we can count on that holding. In fact, they're starting to see a little bit of an upswing in people going out and getting some of the medical care that they perhaps should have gotten during the recession, when people were simply afraid that they couldn't pay for their portion of the care. And one of the things we've also seen during these last few years is a cost shift, people being asked to pay for more of their portion of medical care. Even if they have insurance, those costs have been shifted onto them, so they have larger deductibles, larger co-payments, and as Noam mentioned, prices are going up. So if they have larger shares, that the absolute share of that is larger. And so as we move forward, people are going to be asked to pay more, and that will be a larger share of their income. We've got the baby boomers, as you mentioned, moving into their high health spending years. And so if we're going to sort of arrest this inevitable climb, we've got to find a way to do it now. And that's why it's so important to really re-engineer the entire healthcare delivery system to make it more a more effective and a cost-efficient system.
And I do want to get to that. Noam, I was looking at some figures from the CBO saying that the cost for Medicare today is something like $550 billion a year. By the year 2020, the CBO is predicting more like $1 trillion spent for care under Medicare. Does that seem about right to you?
Well, CBO is a pretty reliable source for data. I mean, as Julie mentioned, the swelling population alone is a huge challenge for government. You know, one thing to keep in mind about the way that healthcare is financed in this country is most people probably don't realize, but over half of the, or close to half of the every dollar spent on healthcare in America is spent by government. There's a Medicare program serving elderly and disabled Americans. There's a Medicaid program serving low-income Americans for the most part. There are systems for government employees, for people in the military, for veterans. So the federal government's share, even before this law was passed, was enormous for a system that we think of as being a private sector healthcare system, as opposed to what you might find in some other Western countries. So Medicare alone is a big part of that challenge, and that's a challenge that frankly existed before the Affordable Care Act was passed. The Affordable Care Act did some things to try to put that program on a more sustainable path for taxpayers. Even champions of the law will concede, including the president, that the law probably didn't do enough, which is why we're beginning to hear more discussion now in the context of the current budget discussion in Washington about controlling Medicare costs.
And Julie, just to making sure our listeners understand, when we understand or when we think about the Affordable Care Act, I guess the cornerstone of that is the mandate. Is that right?
Yeah, it's certainly the most controversial aspect of it. And the idea, the idea of the mandate is that most people, and it's not everyone, but most people will be required to either have health insurance And remember, it's not go out and buy health insurance. If you already have it, then you satisfy the mandate. Either have it or go out and get it starting in 2014, or pay this penalty, which starts out very small and grows later on. But even then, it will be the penalty. It will be a tax penalty, and it will still be smaller than the cost of insurance. And that's for the working age population. Obviously, it does not affect Medicare. There's a huge expansion of Medicaid, although the Supreme Court decision made that optional. And that's another big question going forward: is how many states will go ahead and opt into that Medicaid expansion, and who will be eligible. But it makes many, many more people eligible for Medicaid. And the idea is to have that many more people with insurance, so there will be that much less uncompensated care, as they call it. People who don't have insurance who end up in the emergency room and whose care ends up being paid for by either the state government or the federal government, or being absorbed by the hospitals themselves.
Well, and even going back to Medicare, and I want to make sure we talk about Medicaid as well, but to you, Noam, I know there has been, and it was controversial for a while, the idea that there would be a panel that would make some Medicare decisions for some of those end-of-life decisions. Where does that stand today?
Well, there is no death panel in the healthcare law,
and there never was one. Should we just say that as well?
There never was a death panel. What there had been was a proposal, ironically backed by Republicans and Democrats, to provide additional payment to medical providers to talk with seniors on Medicare about how they wanted to be cared for toward the end of their life. This was actually designed to encourage conversations between physicians and patients, so that when patients got to be in their later years and had more difficulty making decisions about what they wanted in terms of medical care, that they would have a plan in place. Unfortunately, that, as we all know, got blown out of proportion, and that is not in the law.
And that is not in the law. And Julie, about 30% of Medicare spending is in the last year of life.
Yes. Now, what there is in the law, though, and this is still very controversial, is something called the IPAB, the Independent Payment Advisory Board. I've been covering Medicare for 26 years now, and what ends up happening is whenever Congress cuts Medicare, you end up with lawmakers themselves making these decisions about how doctors get paid and how hospitals get paid, and they make all kinds of technical decisions that they themselves say they're not qualified to make, and they have this advisory commission called MedPAC, the Medicare Payment Advisory Council. And who makes these technical opinions that Congress then routinely disregards because there's no teeth to it. So the idea of this IPAB is that they would make more binding decisions. But, of course, the complaint is now if they would make binding decisions that Congress would then have to vote, I think it's a two-thirds to overrule, that then they would be making what are called, rationing decisions or death panel decisions. And that's been the big controversy about the IPAB.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. If that voice sounds familiar to you, that's Julie Rovner, healthcare policy correspondent for NPR. Also with us, Noam Levy, national healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times Tribune. And we are getting an update on the Affordable Care Act. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, Dave and Aaron Go to Work. Created and performed by Barrymore Award-winning Philadelphia artists Dave Jotico and Aaron Cromie. Dave and Aaron Go to Work harkens back to the days of Laurel and Hardy, Charlie Chaplin, and Buster Keaton in a wordless comedy for all ages. Tickets for Dave and Aaron Go to Work are available now at 215-592-9560 or at 1812productions.org.
Wherever you live, whatever you're into, Newsworks.org has you covered. Whether it's insightful reporting on Philadelphia city life, New Jersey politics, or small wonders in Delaware, you're covered. Lovers of the arts, health and science, looking for something unique? You guessed it, covered. Repairing your carburetor? Okay, maybe not everything. But for solid journalism and thought-provoking discussion, choose WHYY's Newsworks.org. Smart, local, news. Covered.
In just a few short years, the Memphis band Big Star produced some of music's most influential records, helping to define the sound of American power pop.
Big Star was, in a sense, a soul band. It's not a fabrication of what you might like to think of as hip. It's a reflection of a lifestyle.
That's Big Star drummer Jody Stevens, who joins us this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Julie Rofner and Noam Levy about the Affordable Care Act. We're looking at what's in place, what remains to be implemented, how states are reacting, and what this all means for you. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's talk about the exchanges. And Noam, if I can begin with you, the deadline was pushed off to December 14th. For states to decide about whether and how to set up an exchange. Why was that postponed for a couple of weeks?
Well, so by way of background, the law envisions that every state will create its own kind of internet-based insurance market, kind of like a Expedia online for shopping for health insurance for those people who don't get health coverage at work. And the idea was that every state currently regulates to one degree or another, its own health insurance. That's a local function, not a federal function. So if states had responsibility for running their own insurance marketplaces, they would are most best positioned to understand how insurers operate in their market. But because the law was as controversial as it was, because it was highly partisan, many states, primarily with Republican governors, swore they wouldn't implement this law. They first hoped that the Supreme Court would throw it out, then they hoped that Mitt Romney would win the presidency and would make this decision irrelevant. Well, of course, the Supreme Court largely upheld the law. Obama won re-election, and so the deadline was November right. for states to let the federal government know whether or not they were going to do this themselves, or they had an option in the law to allow the federal government to do this for them, to come in and basically run an exchange in the state. So at the moment, they're almost close to, I think, about 20 states that have said, we don't want to do it. We'll have the federal government do it. There are a couple fewer states that have said, we're going to do it. Many of them are moving forward, including some big ones like California. And then there are a couple states that have said they're going to partner with the federal government, which was another option. And then a few more, about a dozen more, that have said they're still thinking about it, and because the federal government has given them another month, they have until the middle of December to make this decision.
And Julie, would it matter to a consumer living in California or living in Pennsylvania if the state runs the exchange or if the federal government runs the exchange?
It shouldn't. It should be invisible to the consumer. There will be, 50 state exchanges, and you will go to your exchange either online or there'll be ways to go to storefronts if you don't have a computer, obviously, or to go to a library. Or there will be people who will be available to help you, and your state's exchange will be your state's exchange, whether it's run by your state or by the federal government or by a partnership.
And does the federal government chip in some of the costs if a state decides to partner with the government, Julie?
The federal government is actually paying virtually all of the cost anyway, and that's part of what's holding the states back in making some of these decisions. There have been a lot of federal grants given already. The states are worried about the costs going forward, how much they may have to pay into perpetuity to keep these up and running. But the federal government is paying all of the startup costs, regardless of how it's done.
And to you, Noam, if someone is getting, at least so far, their insurance from their current employer, does exchange mean anything to them today?
Probably not, but one caveat there is people employed by small businesses. There's a provision in the law that creates an exchange as well for small businesses, and if small businesses elect to use these exchanges, there may be different options for an employee to shop for coverage. But if people are working for a large employer that provides health benefits, they wouldn't have to go to this exchange.
And Julie, is there a concern that some employers might decide to stop giving this health insurance benefit for their employees and essentially setting them loose to figure it out on an exchange?
But there are a lot of protections to prevent against that. And first of all, large employers are not allowed onto the exchanges, at least for the first several years. So if you have health insurance through a large employer, these will not apply to you, at least until 2017 at the earliest. But there are certain penalties in the law that make it prohibitively expensive for most employers to, as they say, just dump their employees on the exchange and pay the penalty instead. There's a lot of studies that talked about the speculation that it would be more economically feasible for employers to do that. It wouldn't probably be such a terrible thing for the workers because the exchanges will have a broad choice of plans that will be affordable, and people will probably be eligible for subsidies on the exchanges. So there may be what may turn out to happen is that a lot of people may end up in employer plans who wish they could get coverage on the exchanges and may be stuck in their employer plans. It may be the reverse that people are going to be concerned about, that they would like to be in the exchanges and aren't, rather than the fact that people are, you know, being dumped on the exchanges.
Well, that's interesting. I guess the idea that under an employer plan, Julie, you don't get the kind of option or choices that you get on an exchange.
That's absolutely the case. I mean, these exchanges are really set up so that there will be a large variety of plans at different cost options for people. There'll be these large subsidies. The exchanges are set up so people will be able to tell the difference between the plans. They'll know exactly what's covered and what isn't. They're set up really very much to be very consumer friendly. That was the whole point of this exercise.
Mm. And Noam, do we have a computer system that can handle all these people looking at exchanges?
Well, people are working on it all around the country.
Are they?
The federal government has a big contract to create a system to do this. Individual states are doing it. You know, it's interesting that there are a number of companies now that are contracting with benefit firms to actually provide something like this exchange option for employees. Sears is one of the big companies that is contracting with Aon Hewitt to provide the same kind of menu of options for their employees to go shopping for a broader range of health plans. So the concept is appealing. The challenge is not just the technology, but people currently don't have a lot of experience, most people, shopping for insurance. So I think one of the big challenges will be, how can people compare these plans? It's designed to be customer-friendly, as Julie mentioned. When the rubber hits the road, we'll see sort of how people navigate these.
Consumer-friendly of a very complicated healthcare system. Would you agree with that, Noam?
Definitely.
Julie, would you agree with that as well?
Oh, absolutely. People are really terrified. You know, there was supposed to be all this time to get this up and running, but everybody really, you know, a lot of states really dragged their feet waiting to see first what happened with the Supreme Court and then what happened with the election. And now we're, you know, really 11 months away from this having to be up and running next October 1st. That's when the first open season starts for coverage that begins January 1st, 2014.
And that's Julie Rovner, healthcare policy correspondent for NPR, joining us from NPR. Also with us is Noam Levy, national healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times Tribune, joining us by telephone, and we are talking about the Affordable Care Act, what you need to know about it, and the various provisions that have been rolled out and some that are being rolled out even as we speak, and some of the challenges lying ahead. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Hugh from, it looks like, Souderton to join us. And Hugh, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Marty.
Hi there. Go ahead.
You could describe me as a Marty Moss Cohen groupie.
Okay, go ahead.
My wife died almost 4 years ago, and she covered me and our youngest under her plan where she worked. I'm self-employed. When she died, her employer's plan cut my son and I off at midnight, the night of her death. So I had to go get health insurance because under COBRA, it would have cost us about $1,600 a month. So I got a plan that cost me about $300, and the one for my son for about $100. And that continually went up for the next 3 years. Last summer, we got a refund of $548 under Obamacare because AARP hadn't spent the 80% on direct health care. Well, and then a month later, we were notified that our premium was going from $462 to $353, I think it is, with no reduction in benefits. And they, you know, they gave this long explanation that basically boiled down to, well, we've reviewed our costs and, you know, we don't need to charge as much of a premium.
Well, Hugh, let me take your call, because both of our guests reference the fact that health insurance companies have to spend a certain percentage of their money on care. And Julie, it sounds like Hugh got some of the benefits of that.
That's right. And what's more, Hugh, assuming he's still self-employed, will be eligible to buy insurance on the exchanges when they begin next year. He's exactly the kind of person that these exchanges are aimed at.
And Noam, he mentioned COBRA. COBRA seems to be so expensive. Do you imagine that going out of business? Is there a place for COBRA in the future?
Interesting. I suppose there may be, but probably it would be cost prohibitive. It's already cost prohibitive for a lot of people because, of course, when people get their insurance through work, they only pay, you know, a share of it, 25, 30, 40% of the cost, or sometimes less for some employers. COBRA, if you get hit with COBRA, you have to pay the full cost, including your employer's cost. If you go on the exchange, assuming you qualify and your income is below four times the federal poverty line, which is presumably will be about $90,000 a year for a family of four when this gets started, you will qualify for some subsidy, which effectively is designed to act kind of like the employer contribution works for people who get their coverage through work.
Hugh, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Julie, let's discuss Medicaid for a bit now. And states, I guess, like the exchanges, are also trying to figure out whether to cover more people under Medicaid. Where does that issue stand today?
Well, right now, you know, under the law said that, and the balance here was that Medicaid was supposed to be expanded for people up to 133% of poverty. That's about $15,000 for an individual. And then the exchanges were supposed to pick up after that. The Supreme Court said that that had to be made optional, so states could decide whether or not to do that expansion. And a lot of Republican governors say they do not want to expand Medicaid that high. In many states, particularly for adults, Medicaid eligibility only goes in some cases to, you know, I think in Louisiana maybe 15% of poverty if you're an adult, a non-disabled adult. So, I mean, that would be a very large expansion. And the question is what will become of those people, because you're not eligible to go into the exchange unless you have income of 100% of poverty. So there may be a group of people who are not eligible for Medicaid and not eligible to go into the exchanges who have no place to go. So that's a big question, and they intend to negotiate with the Secretary of Health and Human Services. This was obviously not anticipated under the law, because the law assumed this expansion to be mandatory. Mm-hmm. So there's some question about what the legal possibilities are here, and there's a lot of, you know, kind of a big high stakes political game of chicken going back and forth about what's going to become of these people, whether governors are going to be able to come up with some kind of deal to make the federal government pay more. Remember, the federal government's going to pay virtually all of the costs of this expanded Medicaid population. It's 100% to start. It ratchets down, but it only ratchets down to 90%. Mm-hmm. So even going forward, the federal government pays 90% of the costs of this expanded Medicaid population. But some of the states are worried that even at 10%, it could be a lot of money, and they're mostly worried that as the federal government, as the budget talks go on, that might not last, that the federal government might cut back, leave the states holding the bag for this expanded Medicaid population.
But meanwhile, Noam, you've got people who are, if not in poverty, certainly close to poverty, trying to figure out how to get health care coverage.
At the moment, that's certainly the case. I mean, one of the ironies of the situation Julie just described is that it will be this, in states that decide not to expand their government Medicaid coverage, it will be the poorest adults who will be ineligible for publicly financed health insurance, while you would have people making up to, as I said, 400% of the federal poverty line who would qualify for federal subsidies in these exchanges to get health insurance. Because remember, the exchange is mandatory in the sense that a state can do it or the federal government can do it. There will be an exchange in every state. Medicaid is an option.
So do you imagine either the federal government negotiating something with the states, Noam, to cover these poorest adults?
I mean, I think people, at this point, there are a lot of conversations, at least I hear going on between even some of the most resistant governors around the country with the federal government to talk about how they can do this. Could states phase in their Medicaid expansion? Because remember, again, those states that have been gung-ho about the Affordable Care Act, California, Maryland, Massachusetts, Connecticut, et cetera, these primarily blue states, they're moving forward to implement the Medicaid expansion. Those like Texas, Louisiana, some of the other red states that have fought this law so hard have resisted it. They may not be in a position to get their systems going fast enough to absorb a large population. So yeah, there's a lot of negotiation going on right now. Bear in mind that a lot of notwithstanding the political rhetoric, there's a lot of hospitals, there are a lot of physicians, other medical providers in these states who care for large populations of uninsured people currently, who would like very much for the Medicaid program to grow so that these people who they are currently seeing in their emergency rooms and elsewhere who can't pay their bills can get those picked up by at least the government.
Julie, I'm looking at something that Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett said at a Pennsylvania Press Club appearance about Medicaid, saying we have to look at the costs. Obviously, the governor hasn't decided what to do yet, and I'm assuming that's what other governors are doing.
That's right. But, you know, you also have you have to balance the costs against the costs that are already being spent. As Noam said, there's enormous pressure coming from these safety net providers, particularly public hospitals, saying you have a chance to claim an enormous amount of federal money that would take the place of money that's being spent now by the state itself. And if you turn that down, we're going to be mightily unhappy.
And do they have the kind of influence that sounds like, Julie?
In a lot of states, they do, and that's what's going on. That's the sort of the counter pressure to a lot of these, even in some of these red states. We're seeing it particularly in Florida.
Oh, where there are a lot of older people, obviously.
Yes, but there's also a lot of low-income people, a lot of uninsured people, and a lot of safety net providers, a lot of public hospitals.
And Noam, and I probably should have asked this right off the bat, when you look at our entire healthcare system, what is the cost?
Well, we spend about $2.5 trillion as a nation right now on healthcare, rising quickly. It's about 17-18% of gross domestic product. That's, you know, an order of magnitude larger than as a share of the economy than most other industrialized countries. And as I mentioned earlier, I mean, since so much of that bill is foot by the government at the moment, the concerns that are raised by the Governor Corbett's in Pennsylvania, the Governor Perry in Texas, in some sense, those are coming. There is an ideological component, I think, to part of the criticism and part of the resistance to the Affordable Care Act. But the budgetary concerns that they have are real. The Medicaid, the stress on state budgets currently that the Medicaid program places is very significant. Medicaid currently is funded jointly by the state and federal government. And Julie's right that the Affordable Care Act envisions that at least part of the expansion will be funded by all of the expansion of the Affordable Care Act would be funded largely by the federal government.
And we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Have you been feeling depressed, anxious? The Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit at Penn Medicine is studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders. You may be eligible to participate in a research study looking at the effects of natural supplements to treat the symptoms of depression or anxiety. Initial evaluations determine eligibility for treatment. To learn more about Penn Medicine's Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit, 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
On the next Fresh Air, Hilary Mantel talks about her best-selling historical novel, Wolf Hall, and its recent sequel, Bring Up the Bodies, about the formation of the Church of England, the reign of King Henry VIII, and the beheadings he ordered. Each book won the Man Booker Award, Britain's highest literary honor. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
A recent study shows doctors who've been practicing for decades are just as susceptible to burnout as medical students and doctors in training. These medical pros report a loss of empathy, some feel detached, with a low sense of accomplishment. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, Dr. Burnout. Who's at risk, what's at stake, and what's being done? Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. After a Supreme Court ruling in June and President Obama's re-election earlier this month, it looks like the Affordable Care Act is here to stay. There may be some tweaks here and there, but many provisions will be enacted over the next few years. A number have been rolled out since the law became the law. We're talking about all of this with Noam Levy, national healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times Tribune, and with Julie Rovner, healthcare policy correspondent for National Public Radio for NPR, joining us from their studios. And folks, we all interact with our healthcare system in one way or another. We do have some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Julie, this is kind of a broad question, but even looking at Medicare and at Medicaid, how do doctors and hospitals, I guess, figure into some of the thinking about the costs and coverage, things like that?
In terms of?
In terms of, well, as I said, a very broad question. Let me narrow it down for you. Is there concern that if some of those costs are cut, that doctors, for instance, would not want to treat Medicare or Medicaid patients because it wouldn't be worthwhile to them, financially speaking?
Ah, yes. And this is an ongoing concern. I mean, part of the fiscal cliff negotiations that are going on now have to do with Medicare, with how much doctors are paid. And if nothing is done, and doctor fees under Medicare will be cut, I think it's 27%.
Wow.
And this is an ongoing problem that stems not from anything about the Affordable Care Act. It goes back to the 1997 budget deal and a formula that was created that turned out to have not worked very well, and Congress keeps putting off the cuts, and every time they put it off, they sort of, it's like rolling the snowball down the hill, and the snowball keeps getting bigger. So the cuts keep getting bigger because they keep delaying them, and what was a 5% cut became a 10% cut and then a 20% cut. Now it's up to a 27% cut, and doctors are really extremely cranky about this, with good reason.
Sure.
And do say that, you know, if a 27% cut in Medicare rates were to take effect, they would have to, you know, certainly not take new Medicare patients and think about about what they would do about their existing Medicare patients. Medicaid is a whole separate issue. A lot of doctors already don't take Medicaid patients or take very few because Medicaid, as Noam pointed out, is a joint state-federal program. Rates are set by the states. Many states set very low Medicaid payment rates, and as a result, many doctors just can't afford to take Medicaid patients. And there tends to be an enormous amount of paperwork that goes along with Medicaid. So it can be very difficult if you are a Medicaid patient often to find a provider, not so much a primary care provider, but it can be very difficult to find a specialist who will take Medicaid. That's not so much the case with Medicare, where almost every doctor, at least for now, still takes Medicare. But obviously, if you know Medicare gets cut too much, you could end up with the same problem with Medicare that many people have now with Medicaid.
If you're a Medicaid patient, do you end up going to a clinic where people might be more amenable for covering that care for those costs?
Yes, there are a lot of community health centers where many people with Medicaid go for care. There are many ways to find primary care if you're on Medicaid. There are a lot of Medicaid health plans that cater to Medicaid patients and that do a very good job at coordinating care. The big difficulty with Medicaid is usually finding specialty care.
There's a lot of talk about the Mayo Clinic model, that might be a model going forward that would provide good care at lesser costs. Can you describe what that model is, and is it as good as its supporters say it is?
Well, the model more broadly, and Mayo is one of the practices of this idea, is that you have more coordinated care. So when you and I go to the doctor now, we don't just sort of go see our primary care physician, then we go see our cardiologist or our orthopedic specialist, and they're not talking to each other. They don't have access to our medical records. I'm sure many of your listeners who've gone to the doctor or the hospital have had this incredibly frustrating experience. Well, there is some evidence that if there are more integrated systems in which people share data, in which even physicians and hospitals are working for the same organization, that you have less duplication of services, you have more strategic thinking about what is best for the patient, and that you have better outcomes in the end. People are healthier, and they do better. I talked a little bit about this earlier, that one of the things the Affordable Care Act is designed to do is to encourage this kind of cooperation and coordination of care for patients through what are called accountable care organizations. There's a program within Medicare to do this.
Is that more about outcomes than the kind of typical fee for service?
Well, the idea is both that you would improve the quality, the outcomes, but you also could do it more economically.
Let me get to Eileen from, looks like Doylestown, to join our conversation. Eileen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I've been an emergency room nurse for over about 30 years. And lately, over the past couple of years, I've seen a great increase in young people using emergency room as their primary place of care, even including those who are insured and those that are uninsured. Hmm. And I'm wondering, once everyone becomes insured, first off, where are you going to be seeing these patients? Where are they going to be allowed to be seen? How are you going to get medical doctors to take care of everyone? There's just not enough. And the second thing is, who's going to teach these young people responsibility as to where is the right place to go? How to use their insurance the correct way?
Well, Eileen, I'm just curious, what are they coming to the ER for?
We see they'll come from anything for a pregnancy test to a sore throat. I'm not saying not everyone's in emergency room, but
sure.
I would say 80% of our care is not emergency-based for the young. For the elderly people, yes, it's much more critical.
Well, that's interesting.
You can't say to them, we can't see you. And you can't say to them, where you should go. Our hands are bound to treat them.
Eileen,
it's expensive.
Indeed it is. And Julie, let me give you a chance to weigh in on this. Julie Rovner, what do you think?
Well, one of the things a lot of insurance companies are doing is imposing larger and larger copays for people who go to the emergency room, which can be punitive for people who really need to go to the emergency room. If your kid falls down and breaks an ankle and suddenly you have to pay $300, that can be, a big chunk of money. On the other hand, there are also more and more urgent care clinics, places where you can go and places where insurance companies are trying to steer patients to say, look, if you have a need and you can't get in to see your primary care practitioner, but you have a sore throat or you need a pregnancy test or something else, you don't have to go to the emergency room where it's going to cost $800 to walk through the door. Here is an alternative, and that's a place where insurance companies are actually getting more responsible. They're the ones that need to tell the patients where the appropriate place to go is, and that's the whole idea behind things like these accountable care organizations, that it really needs to be, you need to train patients on where's the appropriate place to access the care system. And that's the idea of making care more cost efficient, making it a better experience for the patient. It's no fun to sit in an emergency room for 3 hours if you have something that's not an emergency, and so you're going to get triaged behind 86 people, and you're going to sit there for that long. You want to go to the most appropriate care. It's not good for the system. It's not good for you as a patient. And so really the healthcare system needs to do a better job at training providers and training patients, but also providing places for patients to go who need something that might not happen between 9 and 5, or whose primary care practitioner may be busy, that there need to be better access points to the healthcare system. That's the idea, is to build a better healthcare system for the practitioners and for the patients.
And Noam, do we have the right kinds of doctors and enough of them to provide the kind of care that the Affordable Care Act is about?
No.
No.
there are parts of the Affordable Care Act that are designed to increase training to handle the huge swell of people getting insurance. But at the moment, no.
Mm. But we don't have enough GPs. We don't have enough.
Well, they're not enough primary care physicians. There's some interest in trying to expand the scope of practice to rely more on nurse practitioners and other physicians' assistants to provide some of the care. That's complicated in many states because of state laws that limit what non-physicians can do. it's going to be a big challenge.
I noticed drugstores are now, you know, doing flu shots and providing some basic care. Julie, is that a trend?
That's exactly the trend. And, you know, you don't need doctors are having to get used to this, but you don't need a doctor to do a lot of these things. You can use a nurse practitioner. You can use a physician assistant. And frankly, you know, as we mentioned earlier, you know, with 78 million baby boomers, about to be needing care, we're going to have to move beyond just the MD to provide a lot of this care.
Let me get Ann from Doylestown to join our conversation. Ann, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I was having a discussion with my mother as I was telling her I wanted to listen to this show this morning, and she immediately said, in Florida right now, I just read an article this morning, Yan, about how we're changing our system for the new healthcare initiative, and we, in Florida, are now establishing an hourly monitoring of people who are brought into the ER, and if they're not deemed admittable, then they also do not qualify for going home and having follow-up care in their home or in a nursing home. So previously, if they were not admitted to the hospital, but they had been diagnosed with, say, a stroke,
right,
they could have then gone to a nursing home or had in-home care and had that paid for through insurance. And she's claiming that's not the case. And as a result, today the paper reported a 92-year-old woman died.
Oh, dear. Well, Ann, let me see if Noam Levy can respond to that. Noam, does that ring a bell with you?
I'm afraid it doesn't. I don't know exactly what that would be, if that's related to the Affordable Care Act or if that's related to some budget situation in Florida. I just don't know. Sorry.
Yeah. Julie, do you know anything about that?
No, I do know there have been some issues with hospitals setting up these are observation units where people get admitted. They actually don't technically get admitted to the they are admitted. They're in the hospital bed and they're in a room, but they're technically under observation, and so they then get discharged because they were never technically an inpatient. Mm-hmm. They then don't qualify for certain post-hospital care, and that's been a big issue, and I believe there's some lawsuits about that.
And sorry,
this sounds related to that, but not quite the same thing.
And thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Noam, I was reading that the Obama administration has proposed some new rules clarifying the insurance company's obligations, and the year 2014, they cannot deny people with pre-existing conditions. You mentioned that before, and that's important for us to understand looking ahead. What else can we look at, I guess, maybe even for 2013, the year that's almost upon us?
Well, there are a couple more things that are going into place now, some taxes. One of the things I don't think we talked about before that was an early part of the law was some additional aid for people on Medicare with their drug prices. The law, anybody who's a senior and has a lot of prescriptions has probably run into what's called the donut hole in Medicare. The law slowly closes that coverage gap, so that there's going to be some more closing in 2013 to do that. But most of the regulations that came out were having to do with how things will work in 2014, not just that insurance companies will have to cover everybody, but their insurance companies will be forbidden from charging higher prices to people who have pre-existing medical conditions, which obviously is a big deal right now. And potentially a one to keep an eye on is there's a provision in the law that limits how much more insurance companies can charge older people compared to younger people. At the moment, if you're 20-something years old, you can go on e-insurance and get a pretty cheap health insurance plan. If you're healthy, you're probably not going to have many claims. If you're older, if you can get a policy at all, it may be very expensive. By narrowing the difference there, you may make insurance more affordable for older people, but it may be more expensive for younger people.
And Julie Rovner, is the Affordable Care Act part of the discussion about the so-called fiscal cliff?
It is. You know, there are some provisions. Normally a law of this size would have had several what they call technical corrections bills. There are some glitches that really need to be fixed. But because this has been so politicized, it hasn't had any. So that would be one thing that would be on the table. Also, there are some you wonder if there are some things that might get traded off, things we talked about, the very controversial IPAB, that the Independent Payment Advisory Board, that it could come up for some discussion. You could see things getting sort of entered into the discussions as lawmakers try to find compromises on other things. So it's not technically on the table, but I wouldn't be surprised to see it brought up in the fiscal cliff negotiations.
Noam Levy, do you think that the tax exclusion for employer-provided health premiums, you think that could be part of a discussion looking ahead?
I think that's probably unlikely. I mean, that though that's a big, big change in the way that many, many millions of Americans get their health coverage. The idea that sort of some of that would additional health benefits would be subject to taxes probably is. I can't see that being part of the part of a big deal right now because it's so controversial. But you know, the size of the subsidies in the health exchanges that we talked about. I think will almost certainly be part of the discussion. They're costly. You know, whether the Obama administration is willing to make any major changes to sort of president's signature legislative achievement at this point, I think is an open question.
And Julie, we're almost out of time, and I kind of set the show up saying, for the most part, the Affordable Care Act is here to stay. Would you agree with that?
I think so. I mean, you know, it's hard to tell whether it's going to be ready on time. That's a big concern. There's a long way to go. And as I say, Congress can always step in and tinker around the edges. And I would certainly, with a law of this size, I would expect them to tinker around the edges.
Well, Julie Rovner, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And she's a healthcare policy correspondent for NPR, joined us from their studios. Noam Levy, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure.
And he's national healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times Tribune. Both of them, joining us today as we got an update on the Affordable Care Act. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about this program, including things like Facebook and Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back. Coming up next, a conversation.